I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. If you've watched the debates or seen the campaign ads, you've undoubtedly noticed a lack of respect. Has the quality of partisan conversation reached an all-time low? We begin today with a look at the causes of incivility in political discourse. We'll ask a former ambassador if it's always been this way, and if there's any hope of refocusing dialogue on the issues instead of mudslinging. Then the racial history of Forsyth County, Georgia, where the past continues to show itself in the county's present-day divide. And we'll bring you the latest edition of Local Listen. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Good morning and welcome to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. I'm Steve Kraske. A campaign of violence in the early 20th century left a community in Georgia with only white residents. We'll dig into the roots of racial violence in America later on this hour. And civility and politics, the two don't have to be mutually exclusive. We'll have a conversation about what's lost when politicians revert to name-calling and insults. But first, we'll check in with the news of the day with KCUR's Lisa Rodriguez. Lisa, good morning.
Morning, Steve.
What's going on today?
Well, people are still talking about a letter sent to the Republican candidate for Missouri Governor Eric Greitens from Chris Koster's campaign. Yesterday, Koster's camp demanded that Greitens release his tax returns and threatened not to debate him until he does.
That's the old debate about debates that goes on every 4 years, it seems like.
Right. You wrote a column about it yesterday.
Yes, I did. It's an old tradition in Missouri politics.
Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, Greitens' campaign ran with it. Multiple press releases accusing Koster of hiding from the people and calling him a crooked career politician. What he hasn't said up to this point is whether he'll actually release those returns. But I should note that Greitens does trail Koster in most polls, so he's likely to be looking forward to more debates to boost his numbers. But you did make a prediction at the end of your column, which is that if they don't end up debating,
no one's going to care anyway.
No one's going to care.
That's right. Absolutely.
So we'll see how that plays out over the next few days.
What else is going on?
Well, talk about the Kansas budget woes never gets old, does it?
I don't think so.
Special task force appointed by Governor Sam Brownback says they need to make some major changes to improve the way the state estimates revenues.
You think?
I know, right? So collections have come up short more often than not this year. And one recommendation made by this task force is raising some eyebrows from Democrats. And that is a proposal to eliminate the monthly report that compares actual tax collections to monthly estimates. And critics of Brownback's policies say that is a politically motivated recommendation. And here is Democratic Senator Laura Kelly from Topeka.
These reports hurt the administration's reputation. They also, going into an election, hurt candidates who are allied with the administration.
So the administration is still deciding whether to adopt that recommendation.
So this notion of finding out every month how well the state is doing when it comes to its revenues might be on its way out the door.
Right. They want to replace it with a year with how the numbers compare over the year before rather than against the estimates.
Okay, Lisa, thanks very much.
Thanks, of course.
American Public Square, in partnership with KCUR 89.3 and the Harry S. Truman Library and Museum, presents Why Can't We Be Friends? Civility and Politics. It'll be on October 13th at the Truman Library. There's a reception at 6 p.m., and the program runs from about 6:30 to 8. Registration is required. Go to AmericanPublicSquare.org. Most of us were taught as children to be polite, respectful, and courteous in our behavior and in our conversations with others. In other words, to be civil. But these days, especially in the political arena, civility seems to have been pushed aside in favor of insults, name-calling, and ignoring what others have to say. But what do we gain, and more importantly, what do we lose by being uncivil? Next Thursday, this panel assembled by the American Public Square will look at civility and politics, and here with me today are two participants from that event, Alan Katz, who served as U.S. Ambassador to Portugal from 2010 to 2013. He'll be on that panel. Ambassador, always nice to have you. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me. I enjoy being here.
And KCUR host and contributor Brian Ellison will moderate next week's discussion. Brian, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Steve.
Ellen, PBS is re-airing the documentary Best of Enemies that looks at the series of debates between William F. Buckley and Gore Vidal back in 1968. I was just watching it last night. Many say that was the point when civil discourse took a backseat to, you know, antagonistic, viewer-grabbing rhetoric. Would you agree, or do you think it goes further back even than that?
Well, I mean, I remember literally watching that on, you know, in real time.
Yeah.
I'm old enough to remember that and being shocked, actually, at the language that was used on television, which in those days was never used on television.
And there was real anger between those two.
It was clear that the two of them really did not like each other at all. But and I think in some ways they reflected the growing intensity of the times. And there have always been issues that have sort of created uncivil dialogue in our politics. I think the difference has been the absence of any civil dialogue. In mm-hmm. other words, people like to point to some early campaigns against Andrew Jackson and then John Adams.
I was going to say Adams and Jefferson.
Right. Yeah. But the point is that that wasn't the only type of interaction. And we seem to have reached a point now where it's harder and harder to find something that one might call civil.
Brian, I'm wondering, what would you say passes for civility in politics these days? Or is there anything left
right.
in the tank?
Or lack thereof.
lack
right?
thereof,
yeah,
yeah.
I mean, I think that is a great question. I think sometimes civility is in the eye of the beholder, right? What one person finds offensive or off-putting is the way other people just talk every day. I think there might be some consensus, though, that we are seeing something of a deterioration that our longing for the past, while maybe a little bit nostalgic, is still there has been a change, and we have to acknowledge that. Consider last night's vice presidential debate, for example, Steve. I, a lot of predictions were that this would be a very dull, the dad bait, rather than a really substantive, feisty going at each other like in the last in the presidential debate.
Right.
That isn't really what happened. Tim Kaine, right out of the gate, surprised people by his interruptions of Mike Pence.
Yeah.
there's sort of a decline in manners that is almost expected and has become typical. I think that's one element of the current incivility. I think, though, maybe the deeper element and maybe the more important one is not just that people are rude to each other, but that the overall tone and content of the things people are saying. Is it about anger and fear and demonizing opponents and negativity, as opposed to being about policy and ideas and direction for the country?
So I guess as an organization, Alan, known for its civility, this conversation seems like a natural for American Public Square. Let our listeners in on the background of the square, Alan. Where did it get its start?
Okay, American Public Square actually began as with a slightly different name in Florida back in around 2006, and that program is still going on in Tallahassee,
Florida. You were
involved
with it.
Yeah,
then,
I started it with several other people, and when I came to Kansas City in 2013, we began American Public Square. The idea essentially, as I describe it is non-like-minded people who are willing to sort of meet in community conversations about very controversial issues in a fact-based civil conversation.
Does that happen?
It actually happens in America today.
I've seen it. It's true.
You know, and one of our best examples that I always point people to here is one of our early programs was on immigration. And we had the national vice president of La Raza, and we had our very own Chris Kobach, and we had a very civil conversation that lasted for about an hour and a half. And it was one of those times when, and part of what we try to demonstrate to people is if we can have this kind of dialogue, really we ought to expect our leaders and our decision makers to be able to conduct themselves differently than they are. And I think the biggest problem that we run into, and Brian alluded to it a moment ago, we have a tendency to, we've always had a divide on significant issues. What we have not had as much of in the past is demonizing the reasons why someone disagrees with you. In other words, you and I can look at the same set of facts and we can come to a different conclusion. I can conclude you do it because you hate poor people or you're a bad guy, or I can say, really, I think you're drawing the wrong conclusion from these facts.
Mm-hmm.
It is the latter that is lacking. It is the former that becomes sort of de rigueur.
Will Kansas City and show up for a civil dialogue, Alan?
Are people hungry for this? We've been very fortunate. We generally have anywhere from 200 to 250 people that regularly show up at the American wow. Public Square events. And we are in our – we're about to enter our third season. We're very excited about the programming we're doing with KCUR this year. We have four programs, and we think that the first one will be at the Truman Library, as you talked about. And, again, I would just emphasize to everyone to know that they are free. There's no charge for these. But we do need you to register. But more importantly, we think that we can demonstrate in this community that, yes, you can have civil dialogue. Yes, you can come out of it with something that is worthwhile in terms of substance. And hopefully the people who have to make the decisions on these on these items or on these issues have a community that is better informed, understands it's generally not – you know, it's my guys versus your guys. These issues are much more complicated, and I think we get better decisions out of our decision makers if the public is better informed. And one of the ways you inform people is people who don't agree with each other having civil conversations.
Now, Brian, you've been at some of these. You've been involved with this group, and you can confirm the authenticity of Alan's statements that people actually show up and guns aren't drawn and swords are put away and everything else.
It's true. And actually, I think I've witnessed some really substantive and indeed civil conversations there. One of the reasons is that there's an assumption from the beginning that folks are going to deal in facts and not in speculation. About their opponent's motivations. One of the
that
elements...
That changes things right away, right?
Well, it does. And of course, it's one of the things that is different from, say, the presidential debate that we saw last week, where there is no one who in real time... Now, there are people checking facts in real time, but they're not doing that on the screen. The candidates themselves don't have to actually deal with whether what they're saying is true or not, unless occasionally the moderator might intervene. Mm-hmm. But in these American Public Square events... there are fact checkers who are set up, listening, ready to say, well, that's actually not true, or that is supported by statistics. We looked it up. Folks from the library actually are there at each discussion.
Right. We have fact checkers, and we also people in the audience who believe that they've heard something that is not factually correct fill out a fact check sheet. It's picked up, and in the midst of this conversation, the moderator will get a signal from the fact checkers that there's a fact check, that and everyone's given a chance to walk it back so that people don't, you know, this is not...
Not a gotcha deal.
It's not a gotcha, what it does do is it really makes people think very carefully about what they're saying. The second part is we ask, tell the audience, no applause. So therefore, people aren't looking, you know, the cheap lines get the most applause. Mm-hmm. If no one's going to react to in the way that you want them to, then chances are those types of phrases aren't going to be part of the dialogue.
And I think that's the point, Alan, is that I've moderated several of these events, and I've never once had a fact check that had to be offered as a actual correction to something that someone said.
Yeah.
Because...
Threat looms.
Exactly. People mm-hmm. know that, and they behave in a more accountable way. And I think the same is true with the civility bells,
yeah.
Steve.
Yeah, we have some, actually, we've gone to a new method now. We used to have two civility bells, where basically one to a Democrat, one to a Republican, where they if someone spoke in a non-civil way, mm-hmm. that they would ring the bell. But what happened, really, what we found was that the people really were a little reluctant to do it because they weren't sure whether they should ring it if they disagreed with something as opposed to it being uncivil. So now we have about seven bells passed around on different tables. And so we invite people, you know, and again, the idea is, first of all, people should enjoy this. We want people to have a good time. And at the same time, we want people to come away recognizing that they're going to learn something and they're going to hear people who know something about a topic have a conversation that is civil and really fact-based.
Now, joining Alan on the panel next week, Brian, are two former governors, James Douglas of Vermont and Mississippi's David Musgrove. Why them?
That's a great question, Steve. I know they're not necessarily household names to everybody, although some will recognize them. Jim Douglas was governor of Vermont for four terms back in the 2000s. He may not be much of a national name because he served 35 years in elected office in Vermont. He was in the House of Representatives. He was the Secretary of State. He was the treasurer. And then a four-term governor. He actually succeeded Howard Dean, which is probably a name you will recognize.
Yeah.
Ronnie Musgrove, on the other hand, was governor of Mississippi for a term. He was lieutenant governor before that. What's interesting about these guys is that Musgrove was a Democrat in a heavily Republican state of Mississippi. Jim Douglas was a Republican in a state that is often thought of as dominated by Democrats, Vermont. They are governors who learned how to govern constructively and conduct conversations in government, in real life, actually with real issues and things that they had to accomplish across party lines in ways that moved their states forward with civility. It's not that they didn't have any controversial issues. Jim Douglas rather famously vetoed the bill authorizing same-sex marriage, for example, in Vermont. His veto was overridden the very next day by the House and the Senate in Vermont. But they managed to have that conversation with civility. Vermont became one of the first states to approve same-sex marriage and didn't have lasting conflict after that pretty serious conversation.
Go ahead, Al.
I was going to say, because, you know, we look at the Congress and we see nothing ever happens, but we forget the fact that at the local and state level, things have to happen, and they do. And what happens is that the partisanship may be as strong, but people who are leaders have figured out a way to kind of move things forward because they really don't have any choice.
Now, I'm wondering, Alan, what you're looking for in this conversation next Thursday. And again, the event's going to be Why Can't We Be Friends? Civility and Politics at the Truman Library. What do you think's going to come out of this?
Well, my hope is this. First of all, I think that part of the conversation will revolve around how we got here, what happened. In other words, what forces have moved us to the point where we don't have very many civil conversations. And I think that part of the other conversation should move in the direction of, okay, we have a very contentious election. We know that whoever wins this election, there are going to be a lot of very unhappy people. And the question is, how do we move forward? What are some ideas? What are some things we might try doing as a society that will sort of in some way mitigate the I think a lot of us are very worried about, which is the animosity that will remain. We as a country really have set a great example, and the Nixon resignation was a great example. The Bush-Gore decision, whatever one thought about it, was a great example of how we as a country have learned we accept results and we move forward.
I'm wondering, Brian, if you think civil conversation and politics is tougher these days because so much of what is said is done on social media and not so much of it these days face-to-face.
I think that is true, Steve. And I think along with that, I would point to things like the 24-hour news cycle. Everything that is said and heard instantly by everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So things that perhaps would have had an opportunity to be walked back or even considered more carefully before being said in the first place, that doesn't happen as much anymore. I think in this campaign, very famously, Donald Trump is an active user of Twitter. And that has gotten him into trouble, I think probably by his own admission and certainly by his campaign's recognition, such that they even have someone else also tweeting from his account now. There are other realities, though, that I think go beyond just the change in medium. There were always ways to be uncivil in the past, and some mm-hmm. people found those ways, whether it be through television interviews or the things they said to reporters or things they leaked to reporters. That has always been a reality. It's a deeper issue than simply how people are saying it. It's what they're saying.
And let me just add one thing, too.
Yeah.
And I think that we would be not facing the fact if we didn't recognize that the media plays a significant role. Because what happens is it's sort of like I say black is black, you say black is white. Okay, there's a false equivalency. Well, you just disagree. And the fact is, the point is that we give the media has given voice
mm-hmm.
to things that in the past they would have just never given voice to.
Right.
They would have just said, you know, this doesn't mean anything, but it's good for ratings. And the competition in the media business, I know, is much tougher these days. So I'm not trying to knock you guys. I'm just sort of saying that it is part of the problem that we have to figure out a way of making all institutions in our country a little more responsible as they go forward.
The program, again, Why Can't We Be Friends? Civility and Politics. It'll be October 13th at the Truman Library. The event begins at 6:30. Registration is required. Go to AmericanPublicSquare.org for more information there. I want to thank former Ambassador Alan Katz for being here. Alan, always good to have you.
Thank you very much.
In case you are, it's Brian Allison. Brian, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about a county in Georgia that ran all black citizens out of town back in 1912. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's program, the media's relationship with politics through the eyes of area journalists. Find the conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, the ethics professors are back. They'll examine the moral questions stemming from recent headlines. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Racial cleansing. We don't often associate that phrase with the United States of America, but that's exactly what happened in Forsyth County, Georgia, beginning about 100 years ago after three young black laborers were accused of raping and murdering a white girl. In the days that followed, bands of white night riders launched a systematic campaign to rid the county of black citizens. Before long, all 1,100 of them were gone, with whites taking over the crops and livestock of their one-time neighbors. Local residents would go on to keep the county all white well into the 1990s. Patrick Phillips is the author of a new book on all this, Blood at the Root, A Racial Cleansing in America. He's an award-winning poet, translator, and professor, as well as a Guggenheim and NEA fellow. He's also the author of Elegy for a Broken Machine, which was a finalist for the National Book Award. And Patrick Phillips grew up in Forsyth County. Patrick, welcome. Nice to have you.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks so much for having me.
You know, what's amazing about this story to me, and there's just a whole lot of things that are amazing about it, is not just the original story that launches the book about what happened back in 1912, but it also struck me it's about what happened in 1987, 75 years later. To mark that anniversary, a group of activists organized a peace march to protest the ongoing segregation of the county again in 1987. Patrick, what happened next?
You know, I was 16 in 1987, and we had lived in the county at that point for about a decade. And we had, you know, Forsyth was still known as a quote-unquote white county. And we had never supported this or believed in it, but there had not really been an obvious opportunity to speak out against it. So in January of 1987, we learned that there was going to be a peace protest that was timed to coincide with the Martin Luther King holiday, which in 87, it was only the second anniversary of the King holiday. And it's easy to forget that that was still controversial.
Mm-hmm.
So a local man organized a march that was supposed to celebrate the King holiday and also speak out against this, at that point, 75 years of segregation in the county and a racial ban that was still being enforced on into my childhood there in the 70s and 80s. So my mother, my father, my sister joined in the march, and they were walking along with this group of about 75 protesters, many of them African-Americans from the King Center in Atlanta and a very small handful of local whites. And, you know, before they got even, it was a very modest plan was to walk into the town square and there would be speeches and a peace rally. But before they even got, 5 minutes down the road, they were surrounded by a mob of hundreds of whites, including many locals, who threw rocks and bottles and beer cans. And, you know, Hosea Williams, who was one of Martin Luther King's right-hand men mm-hmm. during the civil rights marches, you know, was hit in the head with a rock. And eventually the local police and the Georgia Bureau of Investigation started arresting armed men in the crowd. And the march had to be abandoned for fears that someone would be shot.
This was in 1987. It just
stops me. Yeah, it shocked the world. You know, news images, photographs of all of this and news coverage went all over the country and really all over the world. And I think it shocked a lot of people to see, you know, open bigotry. And Hosea Williams had marched on the Edmund Pettus Bridge during the Selma March. So he was there with John Lewis in 1965. And then here he was 22 years later, engaged in exactly the same kind of a protest and facing off against exactly the same kind of white supremacists. So I think people were shocked all over the world.
You know, you witnessed the counter protest. You were there that day. Tell us what you saw.
Yeah, I was 16 that year, and I always include that to excuse the fact that I was late to the march. So on what has turned into one of the most significant days of my life, I was late to meet my parents, and I instead drove my pickup truck and went to the town square where I expected to rendezvous with the marchers. And I had been told that Hosea Williams and other civil rights leaders were going to be giving speeches on the town at the steps of the county courthouse. And I parked my truck and noticed a lot of activity around town. And this is the same town square where I bought my first baseball glove, where I had gone to the 4th of July parade. So this is really home. And I fell in with a group of other young men, and we were all walking towards the courthouse. And at a certain point, I heard a megaphone click on, and someone screamed out, "Raise your hand if you love white power." And all around me, these guys I had been walking with raised their fists and started chanting white power. And then I started looking around and I realized that most of them were wearing camouflage and hunting vests, and a lot of a guy walked by me who was carrying a noose. And that was a moment when I realized that I thought I had been walking towards a peace rally, and I had in fact stumbled my way into the very heart of the Ku Klux Klan's victory celebration.
What did your family make of all this, the events of that day? What was the conversation?
Well, you know, we all reconvened around dinner time that night, and we were, you know, we just shook our heads. We were astonished. We had known that there were a lot of racists and that there was a lot of bigotry in the county. My parents are both from Birmingham, Alabama, and had grown up there in the 50s and 60s in the Birmingham of Bull Connor and George Wallace. So, you know, white supremacists and racists and rebel flags and people talking about white power, this was not a shocker to them. But we were shocked by the violence. We were shocked by the depth of support there seemed to be in the county. You know, seven of the eight people who were arrested at this original march was January 17th, 87. And seven of the eight people who were arrested had local Forsyth County addresses. So we had known that there was a fringe element in the county, but we were shocked to realize the depth of it. And I was very shocked this moment, you know, to be on my own hometown square and to be surrounded by people chanting white power and carrying nooses around.
So you were 16 then in 1987. I'm wondering, when did you begin to learn the history of your county as a kid growing up?
We moved from Northside Atlanta in 1977, and at that moment, they had just completed a new freeway that linked the state capital of Atlanta to the Georgia foothills where Forsyth is. And so my parents were among a very early wave of young Atlanta professionals who were turning Forsyth into a bedroom community and commuting to the city. So when we moved there in 77, I was coming from Atlanta, and I realized pretty early on that this had been, up until recently, a very isolated place, and a lot of my schoolmates were from the same handful of families, the old, quote-unquote, old families of Forsyth County. And I noticed, even as a seven-year-old, that there were no black people anywhere around. And I couldn't help but notice that almost everyone in Forsyth used the N-word. That was, you know, open and accepted, and that was almost the only term I ever heard for people of color. And there were lots and lots of racist jokes and racist slurs. And so I noticed this, and I asked my classmates about it. And that was when I first heard this legend that is really what the book was about trying to unearth the truth behind this old myth that had circulated. And I first heard it in the backseat of the school bus. And the story went that, you know, they said the reason for Scythe is, quote, all white, is that a long, long time ago, and the year was never stated, it was always very vague, a long, long time ago, they said a white woman had been raped and murdered by three black men. And the story went that she'd been found very near the house where I grew up. So this made this loom very large in my imagination, mm-hmm. that it was in the woods that I knew. And the story went that after she was found, she died of her injuries, and then the white men of the county banded together and drove out the entire population of black people, and that they and their descendants had kept it that way. So I was told that this was the origin story and that this is how it would always be.
You know, what did you make of that? I mean, how does a young boy process information like that?
You know, there was a lot of fear among white people in Forsyth County. When Oprah Winfrey came to Forsyth, she filmed an episode of her new talk show.
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah.
Yeah, on the Coming Square in 87. And she said something at the end of that broadcast that in some ways answers your question about how I felt. You know, she said, in addition to all of the bigotry and racism towards black people, she said, there are a lot of white people in this community who are afraid as well. And that's kind of how I felt. It was a place where to speak out or to dissent from the mainstream was to really, you could feel a certain threat and a certain menace if you disagreed. And I, you know, there was people used to talk about you'd get burned out, meaning somebody might set fire to your house or, you know, kill your dog. There were these ways of reacting to those who were seen as violating this norm. So, you know, I was afraid to speak out against some of this. I can confess I was also fascinated by this story because it contained this vanished civilization, and it lived very large in my imagination, the idea that there had been this black community who were simply gone, you know, like Atlantis or something. And so I always wondered, where did they go? Who were they? Where had they lived? Where of the places that I know today used to be part of that world, you know? So I had always been fascinated with the story.
Patrick Phillips is my guest. His new book, Blood at the Root, A Racial Cleansing in America. He'll be speaking at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library at 6:30 on Thursday evening, the Plaza Branch. More information or to RSVP, go to kclibrary.org. You know, your own intersection with this story began one night in 2003, your own literary intersection, when you were doing some research and you typed in the words Forsyth and 1912 into your search engine. Seeing the old newspaper stories seemed to confirm for you something that you'd heard this story before. I had the sense you weren't 100% sure it had actually occurred.
Yeah, the story was always told in this
mythical way. Sense, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, these were the same kids in the backseat of the school bus who told all these racist jokes, who some of them were terrified of Atlanta, which was only 30 miles down the road. So I didn't find the sources of all of this all that trustworthy. And it left me wondering if there had ever actually been a black community in Forsyth. But you're right. When I typed in Forsyth County and 1912 and murder, you know, into a newspaper database, up came all of these results. And I was in the basement of a library, and I just suddenly had this shock of looking at a photograph of six black citizens of Forsyth, and they were surrounded by armed guards because of the militia who had come to try to quell this violence. And three of them were on trial for the murder of this woman, May Crow. And so suddenly that old ghost story that I had always heard emerged on the computer screen as real, and there were names and faces and dates. And, you know, I looked into the eyes of the first black people of Forsyth County I had ever seen, and suddenly I realized that the story was not only out there, but that it might be knowable. It might be possible to learn what really happened.
I was going to say, is that when you decided to do the book?
Yeah, in some ways it all grew out of looking. There's a photograph in the book of these six prisoners, and it includes, you know, two boys, Oscar Daniel, who was 18 years old, and Ernest Knox, who was 16 years old, who were hung for the murder of May Crow. And there's a third man was lynched on the town square, who's not in the picture, but a man named Rob Edwards. Mm-hmm. So when I learned about when I saw these two teenage boys, I realized I had always been led to believe that there were these black rapists, and the newspaper headlines talk about fiendish, low-browed, quote, gorilla-type Negroes, you know, and I suddenly looked at these two teenagers and saw just how unlikely it was that any of that old mythology corresponded to the truth. And so, yeah, as I looked at that photograph, I did think to myself, you know, I don't know that anybody else is ever going to dig this up, so it might fall to me to try to figure out what happened.
You also were pushed by a friend. Tell us about that.
Yeah, in the poetry world, there's a woman named Natasha Trethewey, who some listeners might know. She was Poet Laureate of the United States, a very renowned and wonderful poet. And Natasha grew up in Mississippi, and she's the daughter of a white father and an African-American mother. And she tells the story in some of her work of how her parents had to leave the state of Mississippi in order to get married because their relationship was illegal. It was still, the blue laws were still on the books. So Natasha has written a great deal about the racial history of the country. And we go way back. She also happens to have gone to college in Georgia. And that meant that she understood a little bit about what it meant when I said I was from Forsyth County. Most of the people I know in the writing world, that doesn't ring any bells. But for Natasha, it did. And so, yeah, about 10 years ago, she really challenged me and said, you need to tell this story. You need to write about this. And she posed this very startling question, but one that I think was very apt. She said, why have you not written about race? Do you think somehow race is only a subject for black writers?
Mm-hmm.
And I took that as, you know, it felt like both a challenge to tell the story and also in some ways permission to tell it.
So let's go through this history maybe a step at a time here. The date is September 5th, 1912, and this event that would affect the entire country begins with what you described as a terrifying scream. What happened?
Yeah, a woman named, before the body of May Crow was found in the woods, a young woman named Ellen Grice reported to the newspapers, and it's, I have to quote it, she reported that she, quote, awakened and found a Negro man in her bed. You know, there's no way to know exactly what happened, but this was taken at face value immediately, and the story was elaborated into a tale of a black rapist breaking in through her bedroom window and attacking her in the night. And all the usual things that happened in Jim Crow Georgia happened after such an allegation. Young men were rounded up. The jail was filled with about a half dozen young black men who simply happened to live in the vicinity of Ellen Grice's house. And, you know, significantly, none of those men were ever charged or tried. They were charged. None of them were ever tried. And Ellen Grice herself didn't show up to testify against them. So it's difficult to say exactly what happened that night. But, you know, Ida B. Wells had been writing since the 19th century, calling this kind of thing the old threadbare lie. She said the idea that lynchings begin with the rape of white women by black men. But it led to a real race hysteria. State troops had to be called out to try to calm the mobs. And this was all just dying down about a week later. And things were starting to quiet when May Crow, another young white woman, was found in the woods not far from her house with her head, with grave head injuries. And she spent 2 weeks in a coma and eventually died of her wounds. And that was really the gasoline on the fire of what had already been a tense environment with a lot of real hysteria and ungrounded fear among the white community.
You know, these men were who began the hunt to rid the county of all the African Americans. This posse, this formed very quickly with these night riders. What happened there?
Well, you know, the story I had always been told as a kid, this was another case where the mythology didn't really hold up to much scrutiny. The story I was always told was that the quote-unquote night riders were Klansmen. And people like to say, well, the Klan did that. The Klan ran everybody out. When I looked at it, I discovered that the Ku Klux Klan had actually been prosecuted out of existence in the 1870s. The federal government passed the Ku Klux Klan Act, and there was a really aggressive campaign of prosecutions. And the Klan folded in the 1870s and did not reform into the modern Klan that we know until 1915. So that fundamental fact that the New Wave Klan comes into being in 1915 means there was no such thing as the Klan in 1912 Georgia. And that left the question, so if the Klan didn't do it, if it wasn't white-sheeted night riders with torches, as I had always imagined, who did this?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I found a letter written by a 14-year-old girl. She wrote it when she was 80 years old, but a woman named Ruth Jordan, who was 14 at the time. And there's a line at the end of her letter that really changed my thinking on all of this. And she says, it weren't the Klan done this, it was just ordinary people of the county.
Huh.
And, you know, when she says done this, what she meant was a campaign of terror. They in the first 2 weeks, they burned down 5 churches. The mayor of Cumming writes to the governor to report that 5 churches have been burned. They set fire to sharecroppers' cabins. They fired shotguns into houses and they put dynamite. If you came back, if you tried to come back, a couple of houses were dynamited in the night.
How quickly then did Forsyth settle on the primary suspects in the crime?
They were arrested with
the primary suspects. Yeah.
Yeah. Rob Edwards and Ernest Knox and Oscar Daniel were all arrested within, 24 to 48 hours. The Rob Edwards was lynched within 24 hours. So he was arrested, taken to the county jail, and a mob dragged him out of the jail. He was beaten with crowbars. A noose was dropped over his head, and he was dragged around the square. And again, this is the square that I know. This is a square where I grew up. He was dragged around the square, and his body was then hoisted up from a telephone pole. And it wasn't just a small lynch party. Hundreds of people, the newspapers make it clear, hundreds of people joined in and fired shots into his body when he was hanging there over the square.
This is a pretty fast process. How long did it take to rid the county of the African Americans who lived there?
The report suggests that it really was a couple of months. In the weeks of following May Crow's death, after her funeral, Ruth Jordan said all hell broke loose in Forsyth County. And these nightly raids on black communities happened in the course of September and October. The last people to leave were African Americans who lived in town. Many of them had close relationships with more affluent whites. They were the servants of local doctors or worked in local boarding houses. And so the people in town were the very last to go. But eventually, by the turn of the new year, by the winter, early January of 1913, there were already reports that in neighboring counties that people had gone to visit Forsyth and that there was not a single black person left.
And we're talking about, again, neighbors turning on neighbors here. These were some of the black folks living there, had been living there for years, knew the white people who ran them out of town.
That's absolutely right. And that, again, is one of those myths that didn't bear up to any scrutiny. I had always been led to believe that these were just poor sharecroppers and laborers and field hands. And the implication was they, you know, they had a very marginal existence in the county, so they just packed up and moved on, and that they didn't have much of a hold there. In reality, there were a lot of laborers and sharecroppers, but there were also large property owners. There was a man named Joseph Kellogg who owned 200 acres that he had amassed over, you know, you can watch him through the census records and the tax rolls, amassing this land over 40 years of labor and saving and really shrewd business deals, and just reinvesting all of the profits from his crops into acquiring more and better land. So I found many people in the Black community with very close ties to whites. There was a minister named Levi Greenlee who was a member of an association of clergymen, and the other members were all white, and he was a Black man, but he had been invited to join this association of Baptist clergymen. So I found many of these people in the Black community had very close ties to whites and were very enmeshed in the social fabric of the county. So you're absolutely right. This was neighbors turning on their neighbors and often committing this violence against people they had known and worked with their whole lives.
Patrick Phillips is my guest. If you're just joining us this morning, his new book, Blood at the Root, A Racial Cleansing in America. He'll be speaking at 6:30 on Thursday evening at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. More information, just go to kclibrary.org. You know, I'm wondering, you know, in this book, you go all the way back to the Cherokee removals back in the 1830s, Patrick. Why did you do that?
Well, the reason for that really has to do with the land. Forsyth County was the site, one of the main sites of the Cherokee removals. And in the 1830s, when the federal government ordered that the Cherokee be moved on the Trail of Tears to Oklahoma, one of the main concentration camps, and I think that's really the appropriate word, there were these forts that were built, and not all of the Cherokee went willingly. And, you know, the mayor of Cumming in 1912, who figures prominently in the book, his grandfather served in the Georgia Guard, which was the military unit ordered to go into the woods and round up all of the Cherokee who were unwilling to go. And so, you know, it means that in Forsyth County in 1912, there were people who still had in their family histories this story of the racial cleansing of the Cherokee. So when someone proposed that all of the Black people be punished for this attack on May Crow and that the entire community be run out, a lot of the white people in Forsyth would have known that was possible. You know, a lot of them owed their land and their livelihoods to exactly such a process in the 1830s. So this was the exact same land where this had happened once before.
Yeah, the African Americans who were driven out of Forsyth County, where did they wind up going?
This was another surprise. Again, in the way I was told the story, they had simply vanished into thin air. To my amazement, I found many of them very nearby. A lot of families went south just across the county line into, you know, north counties on the northern end of Atlanta. A lot of them went east across the Chattahoochee River into Hall County. And, you know, I went to high school in Hall County, so I was tormented by the realization that in the 1980s, when I was driving back and forth to my high school, I was driving past the homes of some of these families. And there were people inside those houses who could have told me their memories of being children during all of this if I had only thought to ask. And it, you know, it made me realize that in my entire time there, no one in any history class, no one in any school, no one anywhere ever brought any of this up or talked about it, even though many of the people involved were living very close. Yeah. There were also people who went further. You know, I followed Jane Daniel, whose brother Oscar was hung. Jane barely escaped alive. And she joined the Great Northern Migration and went all the way to Detroit. And I was hopeful that this would be a happy ending, you know, that I had at least one figure in this story who really gets out and who thrives. But when I was looking into the records of Jane's life in Detroit in 1943, in the summer of 1943, as some people may know, there were race riots in Detroit and in her neighborhood of Paradise Valley. What gangs of white men, many of them immigrants, used wooden clubs and beat dozens of African-American residents of Forsyth to death in a, you know, 3 days of violence that came on the heels of an accusation of a rape of a white woman.
Now, this is just a jaw-dropping story. I just am fascinated by this. It's an amazing tale. And the fact that it's true just is buckling my knees here. What became of the crops of the African-Americans who were driven away and their mules and their cattle and everything else?
Well, there's strong suggestion that white neighbors, you know, once people were gone, that they helped themselves to a lot of this. You know, W.E.B. Du Bois, the famous African-American scholar, yeah, he was editor of the Crisis magazine in 1915. He had been living in Atlanta before that at Atlanta University. So he knew of this event. And in 1915, he sent a reporter named Royal Freeman Nash down to ask about it. And Nash was a white man. He was a white socialist who had the ability to kind of pass in the white community as a friend. And he had gotten very good at getting whites to talk to him about events like this. And he wrote an article that appeared in The Crisis that talks of whites coming in with lowball offers for land, lowball offers for land, livestock, or in some cases simply taking crops that were standing in the fields, taking livestock. And he really gives a sense of the way that this became a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for a community of poor whites when suddenly there were people who had no choice but to sell their land. And so many of the black owners sold early and got out with what they could get, but there were other people who simply walked away. And over the course of the 19-teens and 20s, you see a lot of those land lots, which were never sold, mysteriously appearing in other transactions. So it turns out that a lot of those same land lots will later be sold by someone who did not actually have title to the land. You know, I had always imagined these thefts as happening, you know, at the end of a shotgun, but it seems that they often happened very quietly at the county courthouse with a clerk simply approving a sale that should not have been approved.
Hmm. When your family moved back to Forsyth County back in 77, why did your parents pick that place, that particular area?
I've talked with them a lot about that. You know, part of it was purely economic. You know, the freeway, Highway 400, had just made Forsyth into a viable place to live and still commute to Atlanta. So property prices were affordable. They had been living in the sort of northern suburbs of Atlanta and wanted to live in the country. So they were eager to get outside of town and live in the country. And, you know, that still leaves the question of why they would move to a place with this reputation. And I guess one answer is, I think they knew something of its reputation, but I'm not sure anyone in my family realized the depth of it until these events in 1987. And, you know, in 1977, the governor of Georgia had been Lester Maddox, a notorious white supremacist and segregationist. So, you know, when I've talked with them, they've also made it clear if you drove 30 miles in any direction from Atlanta in 1977, you were going to be somewhere where there were a lot of racists and there was a lot of bigotry. And, as you know, I think as people who'd grown up in Birmingham, they were used to that. This was something that you had to deal with wherever you went. But I'm not sure any of us realized just how extraordinary the situation was in Forsyth and until this outbreak of violence in 87.
Patrick, I got 30 seconds here. What's the county like today when it comes to its racial makeup? Because things are changing, right?
Yeah. Today, Forsyth is 10% Asian, 8% Latino. And I'm sorry, that's 10% Latino, 8% Asian, and about 4% African-American. 4%. There's a man named Daniel Blackman, who's a African-American resident who's running for the state Senate. On the other hand, just this week, a woman from Chesity Elementary, right near where all of this happened, made a lot of headlines on the internet for calling Michelle Obama a gorilla on her Facebook page.
Wow.
So on the one hand, you have change and integration, and on the other hand, you have signs that some of this still runs very deep.
Patrick Phillips' book, Blood at the Root, A Racial Cleansing in America. You can see and hear him 6:30 Thursday evening at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library on the plaza. Go to kclibrary.org for more information. Patrick, fascinating story. Thanks very much for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Steve, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Up next, Bill Brownlee with this week's Local Listen. Well, Bill Brownlee's here. KCUR contributor wants to talk about Brody Buster. Tell us about Brody Buster, the child prodigy from the 1990s, Bill.
Brody is a Kansas City, you know, longtime musician. In the 90s, he was a star, maybe Kansas City's most prominent musical export. Today, he works in two formats. He has a blues rock trio and a one-man band.
Wow. The song you picked for today, Brody decided to take on a classic. What are we going to hear here?
We're going to hear Brody's one-man band version of the Beatles' Get Back.
Okay. Is he doing all that at once?
Yeah, Steve.
Or is he layering stuff?
If you're anything like me, you have a hard time patting your head and rubbing your stomach at the same time.
You're taking the words out of my mouth, Bill.
Yeah, so it's like some kind of wizardry when someone can do all that.
And this is what he does now. He's a one-man band, as you said, as part of his act.
Yeah, he does this in barrooms across the city, including the Westport Saloon, every Monday night. And he has some solid original material, but I have the most fun when I hear him do his interpretations of other people's classic material.
I was going to say he'll be at the Westport Saloon on Monday evening, every Monday evening, 4122 Pennsylvania Avenue. You know, he was everywhere when he was a kid, Bill, and he had really legitimate talent. What happened to him?
You know, the problem with kittens, Steve, is they grow up to be cats.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so a 12-year-old, toe-headed harmonica wizard who plays like Chicago bluesman like James Cotton is really cute and fun, you know, but when, you know, he turns 25, it's, the novelty's gone.
Yeah, but the talent?
The talent's still there. His harmonica, as you can hear, is even better than it was when he was a kid. I love his voice. I love, that nasty guitar sound he has. Brody's a real talent, you know, even though his stature is greatly diminished.
Did anything go wrong with him?
Yeah, I think Brody was challenged to make the adjustment from child star on the national stages to, the everyday world the rest of us live in.
Well, that's Brody Busters. We're listening to One Man Band from the Get Back. The song is Get Back from the album Brody Busters, One Man Band. And Bill, always good to have you here. Thanks for the update on Brody Buster.
Thank you, Steve.
You bet. You can listen to previous programs and download our podcast. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up-to-Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow on the program, the ethics professors give us their take on current issues and events. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, Ryan Hennessy, and Corinne Dorian. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.